say, mismanagement of the governments, Islamic governments at the time, or even the other governments, because he is not going to represent only the Islamic government. He's going to bring salvation for all the groups of the people. Look, we have it in the words of Imam Hussein alayhi salam that said that aren't you saying that haq is not being seen, haq is violated, and batil is uplifted? So the same actual circumstances will happen for Imam Zaman alayhi salam. We have it, mulat dhulman wal jawra. The earth is full of oppression and injustice.
Yes.
That is, at this time, Imam comes out of, inshallah, Imam reappears and comes to start his revolution. Again, Imam Sadr alayhi salam said that whatever you are waiting for is not, does not come to you unless after a great time of depression and hopelessness.
Yes.
So when people reach to this level of hopelessness, that there is no one to help them, to save them, this is the time that people are actually tired of every other material power. This is the time that Imam Mahdi comes. The same way that happened to the Kufan and the people of Kufa.
They were
tired of the oppression of the time. They were tired of Yazid and what had happened at the time of Muawiyah and later on after Yazid, after him at the time of Yazid. So they were asking Imam to come.
All right.
But I hope that, inshallah, at the time of the appearance of Imam Zaman, we do not act like what
the Kufan
did.
Yes.
Hopefully, inshallah.
Inshallah. Inshallah, may Allah give us the strength to be on this path, to be on the righteous path, to be the real soldiers of Imam, inshallah. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Alavi. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Stream.
Dr. Buthaina, an honor to be at your presence, and thank you for being with us to discuss pressing issues in Syria.
Thank you very much, Marwa, for coming to Damascus. It's a pleasure having you.
Our honor. Dr. Buthaina, I want us to begin with the ever-complicated game of geopolitics that Syria has a great and big role in it ever since the dawn of history, but specifically in the past two decades. The Western and regional regimes are acting as if Syria is just post-war, and they're trying to find some sort of new ways to maneuver politically with Syria, especially with the on-stage now war between Russia and Ukraine being center stage at the moment. And the biggest issue that Syria is still facing with the four most challenging and pressing issues is the occupation of the U.S. Forces in the eastern part of the Euphrates. You have the occupation of the Turks in the north, occupation of the Israelis in the Golan area, in the Golan Heights, and their aggression, continuous aggression, and also we have remnants of Daesh in certain areas, which are, by the way, in areas where the U.S. is still in Syria. But now, in what stage would you say Syria is right now, considering all these pressing challenges we just mentioned?
First, when the war started on Syria, there were only the Takfiri terrorists who are launching this war in all parts of Syria. only when the Syrian Arab Army with its alliances with Hezbollah, with Russia, with Iran, were able to defeat these terrorists in most areas in Syria, those who were leading the war by proxy, exactly the parties you named, the U.S., Israel, Turkey, jumped into the ground and came in order to continue the mission of the terrorists whose mission was to destroy Syria, to destroy its identity, to destroy its institutions. And therefore, and as you mentioned also, it is paradoxical that Daesh, that the U.S. claims to be fighting, is there in the neighborhood, in the areas, in the domain where the U.S. Steals our oil and our wheat and the resources of the Syrian people. Therefore, we are at another stage, really, of fighting against occupation. So I see these four occupations you mentioned as another side of the coin of the terrorist war that was launched in Syria. And their mission is to continue trying to divide Syria, trying to subjugate the Syrian people, trying to strangle the Syrian people by stealing its resources, by enforcing these extremely horrible unilateral measures that are unknown in humanity, that are against all human and international law. But as the Syrian people defeated the terrorists, they are going to defeat all these occupations, and Syria will be back united. Syria is 10,000 years old. This city, Damascus, is the eldest continuously inhabited capital in the world. The question why? Because its people will always come out from the rubble and rebuild it. And the aggressors are always defeated. And those who occupy parts of our land will be defeated.
Well, it does not take two to realize that when something positive tries to happen in the region, you always have the United States of America trying and attempting to break that positive thing, like, for example, breaking the isolation of Syria. It wouldn't allow it, especially which would put Syria back on the regional scene heavily. Maybe by ensuring its military presence, pressing that they're there to help certain groups. But there's a certain rapprochement that's being spoken about in the media between Syria and Turkey, which is one of the biggest players in the global war against Syria. And when we talk about a rapprochement, we need to talk about trust. Where do you think Syria is on the ladder of trust with Turkey at the moment?
Well, I would like to draw your attention, Marwa, to the fact that we have 830 kilometers borders with Turkey. And if we didn't have these borders, those mercenaries from all over the world would not have been able to come to Syria. What I mean is that Turkey was the gateway for all the terrorists from all over the world to come to Syria. And Turkey was a major player in this terrorist war that was launched on Syria. And of course, it ended up by occupying part of our land when the terrorists could not do the job that it wanted them to do. Therefore, what we hear in the media, for us, it doesn't mean much really, because there is no real initiative on the ground. There is no real talk on the ground. I mean, countries do not start talking through media. If those who occupy our lands have to withdraw first, have to show goodwill that they don't have really the intent to occupy our land for a long period, and that they are ready to withdraw, and that they start withdrawing. At least they honor the agreements they made. Erdogan signed with President Putin. He didn't honor the agreement he signed to withdraw and to let the M4 be free from Latakia to Aleppo. He didn't honor any of the agreements he did. And therefore, they are bubbling in the media. And as you notice, Syria did not say anything because it doesn't mean much to us. It's not serious unless we see serious steps towards this. Trust you build with somebody who's trustworthy, whose history shows that he is trustworthy, but he has to prove on the ground with action, as the Americans say, actions speak louder than words. So all what we hear is words. We need to see actions.
Well, this brings us to discuss the relationship of Syria with its allies this time, and that stood in support of Syria's territorial integrity and Syria's sovereignty against all that had happened. And one of the main allies of Syria is the Russian Federation. It helped fight terrorism and Western neocolonialism, but it's always found in pan-Arab media after every aggression that Syria is faced from the Israeli entity. We see that the media focuses on Russia, our pan-Arab media focuses on Russia negatively. And they say this because they say that because of Russia removing the S-300, this is a permissive move for the Israelis to attack Damascus. Therefore, they hold a similar responsibility. And I know that you might disagree with this, but how would you explain the sideline behavior of Syria's main ally at a time when Israel does not miss a chance to try and break Syria militarily and economically?
Well, let me first comment in your sentence, pan-Arab media. Unfortunately, most of this pan-Arab media does not represent Arab ambitions and Arab rights and does not even reflect the truth about the Arabs. The second part of it is that Russia, as an ally, took the first double veto with China against Western intended aggression towards Syria on 4th of October 2011. Since that time, Russia has taken 17 vetoes against intended Western aggression towards Syria, and China joined Russia in 10 of these vetoes. So this is an ally that you can't trust. Mm-hmm. And then in 2015, as you know, Russia came to the ground with advisors, with Air Force help to the Syrian army to help the Syrian army in fighting terrorism. But all this, if you want, media war against Russia in Syria is to strengthen the enemy, really, and to try and make the people feel that Russia is not trustworthy, that we should not trust Russia. Russia today is fighting a war on behalf of humanity, really, because the war in the Ukraine is, in its truth, is a war between a Western hegemony and between the world that aspires to have its own independent decision and its own integrity. And therefore, Russia, of course, has its own geopolitical needs. And as allies, we understand each other and we agree with each other on any steps. But they did not mention that Russia and the Russian air forces and the Syrian air forces are leading attacks against terrorists in the northeast and the northwest of Syria. They didn't mention the effort Russia is making in order to prevent U.S. allies from partitioning Syria. They don't mention the positive side. We, as Syria, have a trustworthy ally in Russia. Every step, every move is agreed by both, both of us, and there's no problem at all. And just imagine that Syria without allies in the region, or Russia without allies. We need to really solidify our alliance. And I was talking to you off air, that the strength of the West is that they get their alliances together, even to do wars and to do wrong things. So we should do our alliances together and strengthen them to do good things, to keep our identity, to keep our independence, to keep our integrity. All the media that tries to plant doubts, either against Russia or against Iran. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are many in the Arab media now, they say the problem is not Israel, it's Iran.
Definitely, and this is where I want to end off with the allies of Syria here, because it's no secret that Iran and Hezbollah played a great role alongside the Syrian Arab Army in preventing the Takfiri terrorism from Syria and eliminating also from Iraq and Lebanon. But they are also being blamed in the Western mainstream media and Israeli media as well, as they being the reason that Israel is bringing out its weapons and bombing Syria. Have these allies become some sort of a burden for Syria because they are here to help, because that's why Israel is bombing?
No, not at all. The only burden in the region is the Zionist enemy. That is the only burden in the region. As if Israel wasn't an aggressor before this war, as if Israel wasn't an aggressor before we strengthen our relation with Iran and before Hezbollah and Iran come to help Syria. Of course they will criticize, because this is against their agenda. The more we get together, the more angry they will feel. Now, I think the reason why the Zionist enemy and Western allies as well are very careful or very anxious about what's happening in the region is the plan to do a railway between Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. This, for them, is a great threat. They say because it carries arms to Hezbollah. It's not because of that. Because it's going to make the region flourishing region, because it's going to do great service to the people of the region. We have to agree that the ultimate aim of all these wars against us is to prevent us from developing, from prospering, from becoming a major player in the region. That is their aim. And therefore, really, we have to learn that whatever they say, you know, we have to interpret it, analyze it, edit it, and refuse most of it.
Well, that concludes our first segment, but brings us with a great push to our second segment of the show to talk about most pressuring issues happening right here inside Syria, where the Syrian civilians are feeling the most of it, which is the economic hardships, because the calamity to the Syrian economy for over 10 years of Takfiri terrorism, Western illegal, unilateral, punitive measures, they cannot be underestimated and they can be felt by the public. I mean, the heavy combat in Syria is probably over, the heavy bombardment campaigns. But the situation, it's becoming worse by the day economically, especially with the U.S. CSERS Act of 2019, the civilian, so-called Syrian Civilian Protection Act of 2019, and the U.S. looting more than $100 billion of Syrian oil and Syrian resources, where they are occupying land inside of Syria. And there might be some victories still going on the battlefield, and everyone recognizes them, but it's not really tangible to the citizens, but rather the losses are. In your views, how can Syria really survive this painful economic hardship?
Well, before answering this question, let me say something. Yeah. Yesterday, I was attending a lecture by Talal Abu Ghadali at Damascus University, and he said he was on the board of World Trade, International World Trade, and an important paragraph in that is that no country in the world has the right to impose sanction on any other country unilaterally without the approval either of the UN or the World Trade, or without the approval of a body, an international body. And therefore, what the US called Syrian Protection Act, it is actually a criminal act. It's not a protection act. It's a criminal act against the Syrian people. And I see in it a continuation of the terrorist war against Syria, because they failed to make Syria succumb, as you said in your introduction. So they turned now first to occupying the land directly, to robbing our resources. And I don't know how any country can claim to be leading in the world and yet under daylight steals the resources of another people. I mean, this is moral bankruptcy for any country. And so they turn to economic sanctions, to what is called Caesar's Act, in order to strangle the Syrian people. Of course, this is accompanied with the media you mentioned, whether pan-Arab media or Israeli media or Western media, against Russia, against Iran, against Syria, against the steadfastness, in order to make the Syrian people give up and say, okay, we can't do anything. But if they read history, they know that this is not the Syrian people who are going to do that. The Syrian people are going to soldier on with finding new ways of survival. Yesterday, our President Bashar al-Assad reopened the Center for Excellence in Homs. This was first opened in 2009. 2011, the terrorists destroyed it. That was one of the first targets. That proves that they don't want us to be excellent, to be achievers. They want us to be followers of what they want us to do. Syria was able first to make this center carry on in its teaching in Latakia and Damascus everywhere, and now to rebuild this center. And yesterday, students went back to the center. Farmers went back to their lands. They are sowing, they are reaping, they are producing. This huge problem is an opportunity for Syria to be totally self-reliant in everything it wants. And the Syrian people are so creative and so determined and so rooted that no one will be able to uproot them.
Mm-hmm. Does that simply mean that with Syria mending its ties with certain Arab states that were against Syria at one point but now seem to have taken a U-turn, does that new relationship mean they might be willing to fund improvements in economics and development, social development, economic development inside Syria?
Well, that is a political decision, and I don't know whether it's a totally political decision or whether it has to do with those parties who convinced them at the beginning to finance the war. You saw foreign ministers on TV saying that they put $37 billion of dollars to finance the war on Syria. So if they now don't, the world doesn't help Syria, it is, for me, understandable because they didn't want Syria to survive anyway.
But they did open new doors of communication with Syria, for example, like the UAE.
There are new doors, but they haven't yet reached the point of becoming essential for rebuilding in Syria. Because, as I said, you know, we don't know who can and who cannot do to political circumstances and to political decision. Syria is open, and Syria doesn't have a resentment. You know, even internally, President Bashar al-Assad started a reconciliation process many years ago, and it has got its fruition, really, in the country. And therefore, we look to the future. We are not people who work on resentment and who look into the past. What I mean is that, of course, after wars, countries will go back, will start relations, but on certain basis, on the basis of integrity, of dignity, and with full respect to those who sacrifice their lives in order to protect the independent decision of the country. Mm-hmm. That's most important.
And when you say that Syrians do not hold a grudge and do not resent, it's basically because of the bringing up. And bringing up means the role of women in the Syrian society. I mean, the global war in Syria had devastating impact on women. It also had shifted their roles in the workforce inside of Syria. But consequently, women are becoming increasingly influential in the public space in Syria and shaping Syria's future. I want to read an excerpt from your book, which I would love for you to sign for me when we finish our interview. But you say, I believe it is time Arab women learned...
this book.
Yes, I will say exactly the title of the book, which is Both Right and Left-Handed by Dr. Buthaina Shaban. It's about stories of Arab women in our region. And in this book, you practically say that I believe it is time Arab women learned not to fight men's battles while losing out themselves. I think our priority as women should be to help spread a feminist consciousness in every domain and across all categories, social categories, in order to be prepared for these struggles to come. You wrote this in the Both Right and Left-Handed in 1988.
Yeah.
Were Syrian women ready for the tsunami wave that struck in 2011, as it still has shock waves and ripples affecting the ability to create maybe even new unthinkable challenges for these women?
I don't think anybody was ready for this tsunami. I think the whole so-called Arab Spring, which is an Arab disaster, took everybody by surprise. But we quickly adapted to the situation and started to deal with it. And I really believe at times of crisis, as at other times, peaceful times, women have an extremely fundamental role to play. And in this war, as you said, women are the ones who actually bring up their children, who are the ones who plant in their heads the importance of the country, the sacrifice for the country. I mean, if you see the Syrian women whose sons would go to fight terrorists and that they would receive their bodies, first son and second son, and they would say, this is, you know, an honor for us because it is for the sake of the country. I mean, it takes really great bravery for a mother and great also belief, great faith in the country to be able to say that. Now, I wrote this book in the aftermath of the liberation also of Algeria. I made many interviews with Algerian women. And Algerian women said that we were fighting the political war, but without paying attention to our rights. And when the war was over, we did not get our rights. And what I meant is that during the war, when women are sacrificing and women are playing an important role in fighting this war, they should also think of their rights. The whole, not only women, men also should think of radicalizing the society, not just winning the war on the ground in the battlefield, but winning the social war, winning the economic war, winning the human war, winning the educational war. Therefore, that's what I mean, and I believe in that, really. I mean, I was a feminist, I'm still a feminist, but now I believe that I'm capable to fight not only for women, not only for Arab women and men, but for human being in general, everywhere. And therefore, there are basic rules that should apply that would make everybody happier. But I don't believe in Western feminism.
But do you have a chance to survive as Arab women?
I think we always had a chance to survive as Arab women. But the problem is that our media and our culture is not turned into a mainstream. You know, I did a lot of research on Arab women novels, on Arab women writings. Before the First World War, there were 25 Arab journals owned, edited, published by women. Our history is great, but it is not written by our hands. It is not turned into a mainstream. And our feminism, Arab feminism, I claim, is a lot more sensible and courageous than Western feminism. The reason? Because it takes into account a very basic fact that men and women are different, and we do not want an equality. I don't want to look like a man or to be a man, but I want an equal opportunity. That's where the West made a huge mistake, and now neoliberalism is destroying men and women because they are turning even the cartoons for children into very abusive and very, very horrible, immoral way of doing things. Therefore, we are not only facing the West as women to survive, we are, the whole world is facing a horrible neoliberalism that is really destructive to our humanity, to our way of life.
Thank you very much, Dr. Shaban, for your time and for your contribution to our show.
Thank you very much, Marwa, and all the power to you.
Thank you.
I think the world needs you, not only Arab women.
I'm
the world
humbled.
Needs your voice.
I'm humbled by your
Thank
words.
You.
Thank you very much.
علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه و جورسپرودنس is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hojjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned. In an authentic narration by Prophet Muhammad, we read, there are 8 sentences or attributes written about Imam al-Husayn at the throne of Allah. Now, Prophet Muhammad wants to introduce Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam as depicted in the eyes of Allah.
فرمود کنار عرش خدا نوشته شده یک مصباح و هدا
Prophet Muhammad continues the 8 attributes are Al-Husayn is the light of guidance Al-Husayn is the ark of salvation Al-Husayn is the imam of the goodness Al-Husayn is the imam of the blessing Al-Husayn is the imam of the glory. Al-Husayn is the imam of honor. Al-Husayn is the imam of knowledge. And finally, Al-Husayn is the imam for saving. These are the 8 important tributes that are written on the throne of Allah about Imam Al-Husayn alayhi salam. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hojjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
According to the search warrant executed by FBI agents at the former U.S. President Donald Trump's home on Monday, 8th of August, he's under criminal investigation for potential violations of the Espionage Act and additional statutes relating to obstruction of justice and destroying federal government records. We now present you an article written by Julian Borger. The piece is titled, Nuclear or Not? Classified or not, Mar-a-Lago files spell out jeopardy for Trump. Over the course of Friday, 12th of August, the circumstances of recent FBI search of Donald Trump's home at Mar-a-Lago in Florida have come into much sharper focus, which makes them look much worse for the former U.S. president. The unsealed search and seizure warrant shows that it was carried out, in part, under the Espionage Act, a set of statutes dating to 1917 that have been used aggressively to go after leakers, whistleblowers, and the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. The code quoted in the warrant carries a maximum penalty of 10 years imprisonment. The inventory of material taken out of Mar-a-Lago leaves in no doubt the importance of the documents discovered there. They included top-secret and sensitive compartmented information, meaning there were restrictions on its circulation over and above its top-secret status. It should normally only be in a special facility, a SCIF, a Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility, or SCIF, was established at Mar-a-Lago, but it operated as a secure facility only during the Trump presidency. Altogether, there are 5 sets of top-secret documents listed, 3 sets of secret and 3 sets of confidential documents, as well as binders of photographs and, intriguingly, information about the French President Emmanuel Macron. It was the warrant that was unsealed by court order on Friday, 12th of August, not the supporting affidavit from law enforcement, which would have provided a lot more detail. So there is no confirmation one way or another on the Washington Post report that there were nuclear weapons documents among the trove. Nuclear or not, that is an awful lot of classified stuff, especially in view of the fact that 15 boxes of documents had already been removed in January after discussions between the National Archives and Donald Trump's representatives, and then again in June under a grand jury subpoena. Papers removed on Monday, 8th of August, were held back even after that subpoena, and their continuing presence at Mar-a-Lago was confirmed to the FBI by an informant. In the wake of all that focus on the documents, the possibility that they were retained by accident is extremely small. It also looks significant that, in seeking a court warrant, the FBI did not invoke Code 1924, which is normally used in the case of government employees who hang on to documents they should not have. Instead, The Justice Department used Code 2071 relating to the concealment, removal or mutilation of documentation, and Code 1519 concerning the destruction, alteration or falsification of records in federal investigations. Stephen Vladek, a law professor at the University of Texas, said, "That suggests that the government has reason to believe that President Trump has done more than just hold on to these documents." The Trump defense strategy appears to be twofold. One part is the catch-all claim that anything bad must have been planted by the FBI. That is an extraordinary scorched earth path to take in the absence of any evidence, particularly considering that there has already been an attempt by a Trump supporter on an FBI field office, leading to the attacker being killed by police. It may also be legally untenable, as there appears to have been video footage of the search that was available to Trump's representatives to closed circuit television at the time. The Trump camp may not care about that, of course, as long as it muddies the waters. The second strand of the Trump defense, quite contradictory to the first, is that while he was still in the White House, Donald Trump declassified all the material in question by presidential fiat. That would be unusual, to say the least, and would not be how declassification is supposed to work. Asher Rangappa, a former FBI agent, special agent, said on Twitter, "Whatever the president's powers might be to declassify documents, there are good policy and practical reasons for them to follow a process, and for that process to be documented and reflected on the document markings themselves." The Trump Defense Counsel could argue that that is not how Donald Trump rolled. His style was to do things informally. But to a great extent, it is a moot point anyway. The Espionage Act predates the system of classification introduced by executive order after the Second World War, so it makes no reference to it. It talks about national defense information. It does not distinguish between classified and declassified materials, unauthorized retention of any document relevant to the statute remains a crime. However, it is a leap from Donald Trump having a poor legal defense to the prospect of his arrest or criminal charges, steps that would have dramatic political consequences, to say the very least. Although it is called the Espionage Act, it does not necessarily mean that Donald Trump took the documents with the intention of passing them on to a foreign power. The statute also covers more minor offenses. For example, someone who is lawfully in possession of documents, photographs, and so on, and passes them to anyone not entitled to receive it or fails to hand it over to officials who ought to have it. It can also apply to someone who, through gross negligence, permits the same to be removed from its proper place or custody and fails to report it. Fines can be imposed, and the U.S. Justice Department may be satisfied with getting the second documents back under lock and key. Stephen Vladek said, "I still think an arrest and a prosecution are low probability. From the government's perspective, it seems like at least part of this exercise was about just removing things from President Trump's possession, and that's been accomplished, whereas arresting him and prosecuting him raise a whole different slew of political complications." One of three statutes cited in the search warrant, Code 2071, contains a clause stating that anyone who willfully and unlawfully conceals, removes, mutilates, obliterates, falsifies or destroys government documents shall be disqualified from holding any office under the United States law. Here again, Stephen Vladeck is sceptical over whether this can be enforced for this kind of offence. Vladeck said, "There are questions about whether Congress can disqualify someone from the presidency through such a statute." He added, "I think there would be a serious constitutional challenge to Congress's power to disqualify the statute unrelated to the 14th Amendment, unrelated to the insurrection." According to the search warrant executed by FBI agents at Donald Trump's home on Monday, 8th of August, he's under criminal investigation for potential violations of the Espionage Act and additional statutes relating to obstruction of justice and destroying federal government records. The search warrant, that the contents of which were confirmed by The Guardian, shows the FBI was seeking evidence about whether the mishandling of classified documents by Donald Trump, including some marked top secret, amounted to a violation of three criminal statutes. Most probably, the search warrant authorized FBI agents to seize materials from Donald Trump's residence to investigate crimes in connection with the Espionage Act, which outlines the unauthorized retention of national security information that could harm the United States or aid an adversary. The other statutes listed on the search warrant include the federal law that makes it a crime to destroy or conceal a document in order to obstruct a government investigation, and a federal law that prohibits the unlawful removal of government documents more generally. The inclusion of the obstruction statute could be an indication that the Justice Department is investigating Donald Trump not just over the potentially unlawful retention of records, but also whether he attempted to impede the separate or wider criminal inquiry. The disclosures, which came in an attachment to the search warrant, mark a dramatic escalation in the U.S. Justice Department's criminal inquiries into Donald Trump. They represent perhaps one of the most treacherous legal and political moments faced to date by the former president. A conviction for violating any of the detailed laws would be severe. The Espionage Act has a maximum penalty of 10 years in federal prison, and the statute for obstruction has a maximum penalty of 20 years in prison, while the statute for destruction of records can also bar anyone convicted from holding future office.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be looking at a question regarding an event which we are slowly approaching. As you know, in the forthcoming days, we are going to be commemorating the 40th day after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his loyal companions and his beloved family members on the plain of Karbala. A lot of our esteemed listeners, right now they are in the blessed land of Iraq, slowly moving towards the land of Karbala in the procession for Arba'een. We would like to ask them to remember us in their prayers. We would like to also offer our condolences to all of our esteemed listeners all over the world. The question we want to ask today is related to this most momentous event, and that question is about Arba'een. You know, Arba'een, the 40th day after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, is, it's meant to be commemorated. We have been advised to commemorate this day, recite the ziyarat of Arba'een. There's a special ziyarat or homage that we are supposed to and have been recommended to recite. The question that arises in the mind is that where did this, come from? And why is it that we commemorate Imam Hussein's death specifically on the 40th day? So fortunately we have some hadith which kind of allude to perhaps the reason why this could be so. What is the significance of this 40th day? And so we would like to kind of allude to this here today for our esteemed listeners. In a beautiful hadith, it's been narrated from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that he said the following, Ya Zurara. Zurara was one of the closest companions of Imam Sadiq and Imam Bakr alayhi salam. He's a very noble and magnanimous student of both of these two a'immah alayhim salam. Imam Sadiq said, Inna sama'a bakat ala al-Husayn alayhi salam arba'ina sabahan. Verily, the sky cried for Imam Hussein alayhi salam for 40 mornings bidam, with blood, tears of blood. And then the Imam says, Wa innal arda bakat arba'ina sabahan bis sawa. And the earth, it cried for Imam Hussein with blackness. The sky turned black. It turned black out of, mourning Imam Hussein. Wa inna shamsa bakat arba'ina sabahan bil kusufi wal hamra. And the sun, it mourned for Imam Hussein by becoming eclipse and becoming red. Wa innal malaikata bakat arba'ina sabahan alal Hussein. And the angels, they cried for Imam Hussein alayhi salam for 40 nights. This beautiful hadith has been narrated in Mustadrakul Wasail, volume 10, page 314. This is perhaps the reason why this 40th day is very significant, and we've been advised to mourn up to this day and finish it on this day. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at Arba'een in the words of Imam Sadiq. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.